You're about to hear a rebroadcast of the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. This show originally aired on April 6th, 2017.
I got that sunshine in my pocket, got that good soul in my feet, I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops.
It's great to have you joining the party on the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze, inviting you to eat, drink, and be merry with us. My treasured food buddies are here, senior contributors Chris Prosperi, Alex Province, Mark Raymond, and senior producer Robin Doyon Aiken. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
All right, Chris, you and I were talking about this before, how hard it is for everybody to make eggs and feel like they're doing it the right way.
There's something to it. Everyone thinks you can just put the egg in the pan and it's done, but there's little tricks that you can be taught.
I don't know about you, Robin, but I feel like my scrambled eggs are okay. You know, they'll pass muster. No one just runs from the table. But I never feel that they're correct or the best I could do. And I think, how do people – I've tried this. I've tried that. How do people do it? So I met a guy. I went to the Thimble Islands B&B. This is just a gorgeous little B&B on the water in Brantford, Stony Creek,
right?
where all the Thimble Islands are.
Beautiful.
So it's Thimble Islands B&B.
Yeah.
The guy who is the co-host of the place, the co-owner of the place, Tony Broom, is a magnificent scrambled egg cooker.
Egg master, we call them.
What in the world?
He's an egg master.
Yeah. I said, what in the world do you do to these eggs? You've got to tell me. So I've got him on the phone. I thought, I'm dying to hear. Yeah, let's find out what he does. Tony, welcome to the Food Schmooze.
Hello, Faith. How are you?
Well, it's great to have you on the show. Would you walk us through how you make scrambled eggs for your guests in the morning?
Sure. I like to get the eggs out and let them get a little more toward room temperature than coming right out of the refrigerator.
Yeah.
But then I'll break them into a mixing bowl. I saw Anthony Bourdain one time on TV, and he says, only eggs, just beat them a little bit. And he sort of folds them over, and they have streaks of white in them. Well, I have to disagree with him.
100%.
I'll add salt. Then I add just a little bit of milk or half and half. And I beat them with a beater, a mechanical mixer, an egg beater.
An electric beater.
So-called
great
egg beater.
Tip.
What does that do, Chris? Gets more air in there?
Mm-hmm. Loosens them up, sure.
Okay, so there
gets
we
air
go.
In them. Yeah.
And just for a minute or two, you beat them?
Yeah, no, I don't want to overbeat them. Then the proteins get strung out or something.
Okay, now we have the pan. What goes in the pan?
A pat of butter, and I use a nonstick pan.
Okay.
And then on a low flame, I pour the eggs in. I would have to say that I think the secret here is constantly having them moving, using a rubber spatula, and constantly scraping the bottom of the pan. Scraping sounds a little harsh, but just constantly moving the eggs around so that they're cooking evenly and slowly.
Yes.
We
have a mantra where we say small, soft, creamy curds as you're mixing, because that's what you're looking for.
Exactly.
And you keep moving the eggs. You don't let them sit. You just keep moving and moving them. And I think the people always try to make them too hot, the flame too hot. You want a nice low to medium low flame.
It takes a little longer, and you really have to be there. You can't be doing something else.
Yeah, buttering toast. Stay with those eggs.
Stay with those eggs.
Stay with the eggs.
And the flame is on low during this whole time.
Yeah.
The texture of these eggs, it's like a little
creamy
souffle. I mean, it's just
right?
beautiful.
Creamy, light, fluffy.
Beautiful. Tony, congratulations.
Tony's an egg master.
He's an egg master. The guy is. So, Tony, I don't know. I'm just going to start stopping by at breakfast time.
We all are.
Thimble Islands B&B.
Well, we'll be here.
Oh, my goodness. What a spot you have looking out on the water like that. I mean, you feel like you're on a boat. It's just incredible.
Well, we have personal flotation devices under the bed.
So. Okay, but the eggs, they are the thing. And what's that caramelized? I think I took a picture of it. The caramelized French toast?
Oh, the creme brulee French toast.
Oh, my God.
Oh, boy.
So
that just sounds good.
Is that it dessert?
It is nutty delicious.
Well, that's Julie's forte.
Tony Broom, who is co-host and owner of the Thimble Islands B&B in Stony Creek, Connecticut, where they make, after you've stayed there, the best scrambled eggs on the planet, I think. I've never tasted anything like them. They're just magnificent. Thank you, Eggmaster.
Well, thank you, Faith.
You're welcome. We'll put some egg stuff up on the site. So that's at foodschmooze.org, and we'll link to the B&B. So I don't know if you can call them and say we want to come for breakfast.
No, but come on, get away.
Yeah,
you can get away.
It's gorgeous. Right. So that, and we should have Julie on to talk about that French toast.
Mm-hmm. Is it crispy like a creme brulee?
Yes,
the sugar's caramelized
totally.
On top?
It's just all delicious. Right. Okay.
Well, it is brunch season.
That's right. Let's open up the conversation. Mm-hmm. Well, what would we do for brunch? What do you serve? Do you do the mimosa thing? What is
Cava.
Your brunch drink?
Cava.
Mm.
Yeah,
so,
Cava.
For people
Cava.
Who don't know what that is, yeah. Spanish.
It's Spanish sparkling wine from Barcelona.
And it's very dry.
Very dry. Brut.
And
bone dry.
So affordable.
And so delicious.
But yeah, but the quality is very high. It's
always.
Great quality.
Yeah.
I love Cava too.
I love
too.
Cava yeah. myself, yeah.
That would be
absolutely.
My favorite. And I actually prefer it without stuff in it. You know, the
yeah.
orange juice or
great.
The peach
oh.
juice.
So mimosa
or
without
or
orange juice. That's how I like
it.
Like,
you just like the sparkling.
Sans
the
orange
sparkling
juice.
Wine with eggs, I think, is just a fantastic combination.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't know, but what do
sparkling
you do, Robin?
With
what do you do? What's your go-to drink?
Well, right along the lines of Cava, I have made mimosas with Prosecco.
That works.
Kind of a classic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if you have other drinks there, other brunch drinks, you still have to have a mimosa.
Yeah, know? And do you do freshly squeezed
oh,
orange
sure.
juice? Or?
Of course.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Okay. Chris?
I do two things at once. I do a shrimp or crab cocktail.
Okay.
And it literally
wow.
is a appetizer and a drink all at once.
How we're going to your
house. Do that?
I came up with it years ago. We were having people over for brunch and I overslept. And my job was to get the drinks for when people come in, because that's the first thing you have to do, and to do a little appetizer. So what I decided I was going to do was Bloody Marys, and I was going to do a little crab salad, you know, maybe on a little toast. So I wake up late, I'm not even showered, people are pulling in the driveway.
Uh-oh.
I had set up
bad
the
host.
I set up the bar for the, you know, for the Bloody Marys already. So I had the mix made in the refrigerator, I had the glasses out, I had all that set up. And I had the crab already in a bowl, ready to go in the refrigerator. And I just was going to chop some stuff up. I don't know. I just panicked. And all of a sudden, I said, you know what? I'm just going to do it all at once. I had these nice, like, martini-style glasses. I threw the crab meat into the glasses. And then in a martini shaker, I poured my Bloody uh-huh. Mary mix. I put a big splash of vodka in. And then I drizzled in some olive oil and a little extra lemon juice. And as people were coming in the door, I was shaking it up on ice and pouring it over the crab salad and then gave them a little fork to eat the crab
salad.
So they
salad. Had a drink
Favorite and
so
they had their salad. Drink. They had their cocktail and their appetizer all at once.
Wow.
Yep.
I think
That's
that
a
is
great
a
idea.
Genius
yep.
idea.
You could have
yeah.
pretended not to be home.
That did cross my mind, but I
You're
did
hiding.
Invite everybody, so that would have been hard to believe me. If I could have got out of this at that point, I mean, I literally woke up as people were pulling
wow,
in the
bathroom. Wow, I love this.
Hair sticking up.
You
brush your
them?
Teeth.
Yeah, brushing my teeth and shaking a martini. Yeah.
You handed them a savory cocktail, and they did not even notice that you had not brushed your hair.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
That's
no
right.
one said. I didn't say anything. No one said anything to me. As people
Was
were
that the
standing,
whole breakfast or what?
Yeah, no, no. As people... No, I was all set up to do a brunch afterwards,
okay.
but they
okay.
gave me the
okay.
time. Right? People were mulling around saying, oh, this is great. This is great. I'm like,
I thought as
you know,
soon as they
oh,
finished.
I gotta, I'll be right back. I run
Bye,
upstairs to the bathroom.
Thank you for coming.
Quick shower.
Yeah. And then...
Is that the hair dryer?
Yeah. yeah. Once people got settled, then I broke out the eggs. And
that
started
is great. Okay. What about you, Mark? What are you? What's your
Well, I've always been
your
a classic Bloody Mary, you know, but I've recently found a really cool, like, spicy vodka.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in
yeah.
an upcoming show.
Absolutely.
Wait till you hear about this thing.
So good.
Wow.
But another cool idea along the lines of the Cava is turning that into sort of a white wine sangria.
Ooh.
You know, chopping up some fresh fruit and putting it into either Cava or white wine. people love fresh fruit in the morning. So.
Oh, that's a great idea.
You know, and plus, you do it the night before. Your pineapple. Yeah.
No sits in the fridge.
Sits in there, soaks in that.
No matter what wine. You have coming after, it just somehow goes with it, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
White sangria.
Absolutely.
What kind of white wine do you use?
For me, I'd use something along the lines of either a Sauvignon Blanc, something crisp mm-hmm. and bright like that, or maybe even a white Rioja, which would be fun, too.
That's good.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe even a Torontes from
Chile.
Yeah, from Argentina.
Oh, Argentina. Okay.
You know the other one I like is the beer and clamato juice.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Do you ever have one of those?
The
We've done that hey, on the show, haven't we?
Yeah.
We
I just think that's a great Sunday. You know, if you want to stay away from wine or vodka or cocktail-y kind of things and you want something that's a little different.
I've loved all of these suggestions, but I think we need inspiration. I'm going to ask you now, we're going to ask you on Facebook to tell us what is your brunch drink? What is your go-to drink? Maybe you have alcohol, maybe you don't. You know, there might be kids at the table, whatever you choose to do. And it may be that there's a particular restaurant you go to, because on a Sunday, I used to have a tradition years ago in Provincetown of going to a particular place on a Sunday, and they had a particular drink for brunch that was so fabulous. And these, you know, quite fabulous guys would walk around with trays, and they were in Coast Guard suits with,
nice.
With Coast Guard hats. Honestly, it was like a Bette Midler routine. Honestly, it was the most hilarious, funny thing. But the drinks were delicious, so I'll talk about that later. What about you? Is there a particular place that makes a drink? Remember, I went to that place in Mystic that did the Bloody Mary with the bacon strip.
Oh, yeah. Engine
came
room.
To the table. Engine Room in Mystic, Connecticut.
Engine Room,
I want you to go to Facebook right now and please talk with all of us about what kind of brunch drink you serve and where do you get a brunch drink that you absolutely love. It's Faith Middleton Food Schmooze on Facebook. Can't wait to hear from you, and we'll chat back and forth with you.
Yeah.
We have coming up the cookbook, Gluten-Free Cooking for Two. Now, if you are gluten-free, most recipes are for 4, 6, or 8 people. Mm. So this is filling a niche in the market where if you're just 2 people and you want to be gluten-free or one of your guests is gluten-free, everybody can eat this. So whether you're gluten-free or not, you're going to, I think, have a good time with these recipes. Really, really fun. Chris knows that I found an article in the New York Times that knocked me out. It's called, As Japan Ages, Menus Adapt to Finding the Gourmet in Purees. This is a story about how Japan has the largest elderly population in the world.
Wow.
Huh.
And that chefs, homes where old people stay, restaurants, elderly people are quite revered in Japan, treated with tremendous respect.
I love that.
The chefs and all the food people are taking it seriously upon themselves to adapt the food world to serve them and have them be as happy as everybody else.
And they're really taking it to a new level, right?
Not just the pureed peas.
Yeah, and again, not just taking food and putting it in a blender, right, Faith? They were really making things look like they really are or were. So in other words, they're molding it. And
yes.
It was pretty amazing. Like
using thickeners?
And go ahead,
well,
Faith.
So companies in Japan are developing these special thickening products that aren't junky or chemical-based, you know,
ones.
Weird. On this recent afternoon, the story says they have this lunch menu of Japanese sea bass, sweet and sour marinated carrots and radishes with a side dish of spinach and mushrooms. So because when people are quite old, they have a little more difficulty swallowing, and there's a small portion of the elderly who have a tremendous amount of difficulty swallowing. So they said, what can we do about this? They revere old people. Let's fix this for them. So what they did at this restaurant was they swapped out the sea bass for a softer fish, flounder. They took the mushrooms out. That's for the soft swallowers. Then for the serious problem swallowers, they put the entire meal, the protein, into a food processor, became a puree. They added the thickening agent. Now it's a soft block. And then they put the soft block in a fish mold, took it out of the fish mold, put seasonings on it, and did, you know, like fins with the carrots and the...
So it doesn't look different it than looks, other food.
It tastes like fish. It's gorgeous, and they can swallow it.
And it's actually fish.
It's just beautiful.
We should treat older people like that here.
Yeah.
As all of us sitting here are heading in that direction quite quickly.
Here, take out your teeth, Chris.
I would like to enjoy food when I am 100 years old.
Why should
I not have the whole experience of that pleasure of the food just because I'm 100?
Exactly.
So chefs said that they were so upset. Like one chef talks about watching this man who is 80. The second that leeks came onto his plate, fork came out, pushed him aside. And the chef thought, I am not going to be a restaurant that doesn't take care of our elderly. I'm doing it. And so he did this whole kind
really
of thing. And these nursing homes in Japan are now adapting this. And I thought this was so incredible.
We could follow that lead, right?
I know a man who was in a nursing home because he is quite debilitated from a stroke. And they don't want him to have alcohol in the nurse, not because his condition says he should have no alcohol, but because they think it's kind of, quote unquote, bad for the nursing home. And I think, what in the world would you do that
Let
for?
Let him live.
Yeah. You know, I suspect he has it anyway. Some friendly visitors.
mm-hmm. Bottles under the bed.
I mean, this is clear. I mean, somebody's got a medication issue. Of course, I'm not advocating that, but this is, I think, something else.
But I think it's the idea of just because someone's old doesn't mean that they can't have quality of life and be respected and allowed to be happy and to continue living and not rushing them to something.
And I must say that there are a lot of drugs now. In the past, if you had chemo, it was very difficult. You couldn't eat. Felt awful. Nothing appealed to you. But there are some drugs now that help preserve the appetite of people, even with serious chemo and radiation treatments.
Right.
You know, my good friend Joy Wilkie, we had pizzas and her favorite sparkling wine, champagne, right up into the end. And she could taste it all. She loved it.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was so wonderful.
Yeah.
I hope that happens for all of us. Listen, on the other side of this break, we have a great red wine, a discovery for you. One of the most delicious in a while, $20 a bottle. So I think quite affordable for in terms of what the flavor of this wine is. More mouthwatering conversation and fun ahead on the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. I hope you will make a charitable contribution to Feed the Hungry. Their numbers are growing, folks. We're online now at foodschmooze.org, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. This show originally aired April 6th, 2017.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread had a fight. Beans knocked cornbread out of sight. Beans. Cornbread said, now that's all right. Beans. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night.
We have a free podcast for you, meaning you'll never miss a drop of pleasure on this show. All you do is go to our site, you sign up for it once, and you can listen whenever you want to. Foodschmooze.org, and you'll see podcast delivery. I'm with my treasured food buddies. I just adore these people. Chris Brosberry, chef and co-owner of Metro Bisa Restaurant in Simsbury, Connecticut. Wine broker Alex Province. And Mark Raymond, our wine broker. And Robin Doyen-Aiken, our senior producer. Here we go. We promised you a good wine discovery. I like this enough so that I went out and bought a case of it myself. It's $20 a bottle. It's a category for me where I would bring this to someone's home as a host gift. If it's a birthday or something, I might move up even to 50.
And this is on the lower side of that?
So this is $20, right? And it is a Spanish wine. It's a Rioja. It is a beautiful red from Spain, Barón de Ley, and it's a Reserva. Mark, your discovery. Thank you for this.
This is a wonderful wine that I've been drinking for many, many vintages, and the 2010 is really special, but it is 100% Tempranillo, and they put it in barrel for, 24 months, and then in the bottle for another year.
Oh.
What I love about this is just the silkiness on the palate.
Yeah. Right? It's just so luscious.
It has a kind of lip-smacking quality to it. So it's all Tempranillo.
Yes.
Now, normally, just all Tempranillo doesn't have a little kind of backbone. This does.
That 2 years in new French and American oak.
That's what does
really
it. Really. Wow.
Just gives it
what
some
would
great
this go well
depth.
With? What do you all think?
Tempranillo is very similar to Pinot Noir. So I would do the classics. Duck would be great.
Chicken.
Chicken, anything
salmon.
With tomato sauce is wonderful.
You would?
Salmon
absolutely.
Is perfect
tomato
with rizzo.
Salmon is fantastic with rizzo.
Oh, yeah.
You do your classic paella, too, if you wanted, if you're really Spanish.
Yeah.
You know,
with the chorizo and the fish and the
in Spain, in chicken. Rioja, where this comes from, Tempranillo would be the wine that they have with their entire cuisine. You know, here we have the luxury of having a zillion different grapes to choose from. Mm-hmm. In that region, the north coast of Spain, most of the red wines, Tempranillo, are coming from Rioja. So it's going with all that great Spanish food.
One of the things I had this recently with is we make chimichurri sauce with the parsley and the garlic.
Yeah.
So I just take chicken thighs, put them into a deep dish pan, rub them down with salt and then a little bit of chimichurri, and then roast them in the oven. It is so good.
I like that.
For a Monday, Tuesday night, Wednesday, actually anytime, it's an easy one. You put the chicken in the oven for 45 minutes, you're done. It's great.
Oh. I like that.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing about Rioja that's awesome is that it's an appellation. It's a DOC in Spain, so it's so highly regulated. They regulate everything about the making of this wine, from how much grapes you can get from the land, whether or not you can add fertilizer, whether or not you can add sugar, which they can't, by definition, how long it has to be in tank and barrel. Spain's finest wine comes from this region, Rioja. I have a basement full of this stuff. It's my favorite stuff to drink.
It's probably the most recognized wine out of Spain. People see the name Rioja and they're like, oh, I love Rioja.
Mm-hmm.
Rioja's, you know.
Me too.
And it's so delicious, so easy drinking. And there's so many different variations. You can get the Crianza, which spends a little less time in barrel. You get Reserva. And then if you really want something super special that can be anywhere from like $30 to $50 a bottle, you get the Gran Reserva, which is, they do all the aging for you, is basically what that style is.
Where is this?
Rioja. And it's in a little town called Mendavia, which is just outside of Logroño, maybe 30 minutes south of Logroño.
If you took a flight to Madrid, rented a car, if you drove straight 4 hours to the north, you'll hit a mountain range called the Cantabria Mountain Range. And if you think of Ireland as being wet, well, this mountain range causes all the rain to fall on one side, which is Galicia, and then where Rioja is, it's dry. They plant the grapes right up to this cliff that comes out of the ground. I mean,
it's so cool.
If you're into like wine country, Rioja is as pretty
so
as they get.
Spectacular, yeah.
Oh,
so pretty.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I have to see that.
Absolutely.
Another road trip?
I feel a trip coming up.
A road trip.
Anyway, this is on our website, and this is Baron, thank you, Mark Raymond,
yeah.
Baron Delay. Baron Deley. It's a Reserva Rioja. We're going to feature the 2011 pretty much, which is just coming in and tastes quite good, according to Mark. So,
fantastic.
You'll see this on our website, foodschmooze.org. Great gift wine if, you go, awesome. If it's somebody's birthday. Or,
gets
or
two host yummies
gift.
For me.
Yeah, two yummies. Yeah.
What's the scale of the
me
yummies?
Me too.
It's 1 to 3 yummies.
For me,
this
for
is
me right.
Right.
Yeah. I bought a case of this. For,
yeah, that's
because,
that says a lot.
Yeah.
And I would put a slight chill on this too.
Cellar temperature.
Yeah.
Not
great idea.
In the refrigerator for 10 or 20 minutes. It should really be like
60s.
You know, under 60 degrees is so good.
By the way, I had a Rioja last night, which I had ordered a glass of to try, knowing what we were going to do today. This was another Rioja. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, I'm hungry. So I did it backwards. I ordered the wine first. And then I realized what I wanted was crab cakes. Now, you wouldn't normally pick a Rioja to go with crab cakes, technically. It was delicious together.
Yeah, it's a great pairing. Yeah,
yeah. I was going to say,
the wines are very versatile from Rioja. Oh, they really are.
You know, a fun pairing is Manchego cheese. So if you're a Manchego cheese fan, that in a glass of Rioja.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
that's how I like
good.
To end the meal, right?
Yeah. Or start, no, sure. Or skip start, the meal. Just eat the cheese.
Just cheese and wine.
Yeah. Hey, has anybody had a food failure lately? I just had one. How about you? Anybody have one?
Food failure.
One that we want to admit?
Sure. I always think it's encouraging to hear these. Let me tell you what happened. I was making Johnny cakes, and I didn't really watch carefully, and I burned them. I mean, black in the cast iron skillet. And I was so furious.
Aww.
And so I just took the spatula and just threw them in the trash. And then I just said, for God's sakes, I want cornbread, something right now. Grabbed a bowl in a kind of kitchen fury, threw cornmeal in, didn't even measure it. You know, you have to measure it in baking. Didn't measure it, just went into the bowl. Then I went and got some butter and I just threw it in. I just grabbed some flour, no measuring. Salt, just grabbed my hand into the salt thing and went in the. I thought, if this comes out, it will be a miracle. So dumped it, stir, dumped it into the, on milk. Dumped it into the cast iron skillet with a little bacon grease on the bottom, threw it in the oven. I don't even look at the timer. I'm just standing around, just infuriated with myself. Out it comes, and what had I created? It was either, it's like a cross between a pancake.
A corn pancake.
And a cookie.
All right,
sure.
It was fantastic.
Corn cookies,
it
I
was
like it.
Really, and then
should've
I
should have wrote
I
all thought, those ingredients, those
was
measurements
so
down.
Crunchy, crispy.
It sounds so colonial.
Thin.
Yeah.
And
so
I thought,
that
wow,
mystic seaport.
This is like, yeah. I had a bonnet
people,
on.
People in period clothing serving it, right?
So and then I thought, okay, what can I do now? So I put butter on the top of each, cut it in wedges.
Nice.
Butter on the top, put it in the toaster oven,
yeah.
And crisped up so that the tops had this buttery thing, and it was like eating, I don't know.
It was a crunchy
thing. Doesn't have to be, right? Doesn't have to be difficult or measured.
I think I should do a cookbook, Cooking While Furious.
Yeah. Nice.
My mom always says to never cry while you're cooking because you'll put your sadness into the food.
Aww.
So
that is true.
Yeah, in this case, Faith made this pancake. Fear for its life. It had to be good.
I like that. Yeah. That's
there
a good way to put it.
So I've got one that's not mine. So I got a text the other day from my friend Bob saying his crab cakes were falling apart. And so Matt's trying to Google and thinking, all right, put the batter in the refrigerator for an hour and it helps it. Is that right, Chris?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that didn't work for him.
Yeah.
And then Matt said, oh, you should propose like an egg as a binder. And then he called to say, no, it still fell apart. So what did he do wrong, you
what
think?
What would you do, Chris, if you had
so
that happen?
He made a
crab cake
batter, and it fell apart. Then it's too wet.
So more breadcrumbs?
Yeah.
Or?
And that's the thing. With breadcrumbs,
more
I don't –
More breadcrumbs or more crab?
I don't like crab cakes that are all breading. What I always do and when I tell people to make crab cakes is to start without the crab. To get the consistency of the medium done first, then you can add as little binder as you need. So start off with a little breadcrumb because you need a little, right?
Yeah.
And then add your – it's usually mayonnaise to it, right? So add your mayonnaise to your mixture. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, it has to have Old Bay. And you get that to a good consistency. So don't add a lot of mayonnaise. Just add a little teaspoon at a time, right? And mix it until you
and
get
it.
And
what do I want you for my consistency?
You want to be able to mold it in your hands.
And when does
just
the crab go in?
The crab goes in after you get that consistency because then you can load it with crab and you have the binder already set.
Yeah, okay.
Does that make sense?
Good.
Right?
Yes.
Because once you get to where your friend was, then the only way to fix it really is to keep adding stuff till you get it to that consistency. And now you're going to have a lot more breading probably.
And you wasted all your crab too.
Yeah, and your crab's already in there. And the only way to get it back to make it formable crab cakes is actually to have more stuff in it.
I have a greedy question for you. How could I make almost solid crab cake? I'm going to have a little crunch on the outside, and so that my crab meat is bound with something, and then I'm going to put it in a crunchy outside.
We make that as an appetizer sometimes, and then what we do there is we take our crab meat and we just mix it with a little bit of egg. That's it. Nothing else in seasoning, Old Bay and whatever. And then we bread the outside of it.
That's
so
what
the
I'm talking
filling
about.
Isn't. Oh. So there's no bread on the inside. But it's not, I mean, this is the thing. Yeah, and I've been doing this with crab cakes for a long time now. You don't want to, when you get people in from the Chesapeake Bay area, if the crab, even though you're using the blue crab from the Chesapeake Bay, if you don't get the proportions down right with the way they taste and feel in your mouth, they will come into the kitchen And almost give it to you as far as messing up the crab cake. And you can even explain, well, I did a different style of crab cake and I made that mistake once. Because when the Chesapeake Bay, there is no other style of crab cake.
Well, you I have to say that their crab cakes
are the best, right?
The best. Yeah. Just fall to your knees. Incredible.
They have fresh crab that's still alive. Yeah. And
it's not as expensive for them as
crab, though.
When you use the pasteurized canned crab in a crab cake, very hard to tell the difference.
Yeah.
Now, when you're eating it, totally easy to tell the difference. But if it's mixed in a crab cake, it's hot. It has the sauce on the side.
So for me to make a pure crab cake and just roll the patty in some breading on the
end. And then fry it.
What did you say it was?
Just a little bit of
crab meat.
And a little bit of egg.
Bay seasoning.
And I might not even use a whole egg.
I'll whip the egg.
And then I'll add the egg to the crab just to, again, get it to where I can form a patty. And these are very loose and really delicate. So you have to be very careful, and then you very softly flour, egg, breadcrumb. And then I may even do egg, breadcrumb one more time just to make sure it holds nice and together, and then deep fry it.
So maybe soft shell crab is easier.
Soft shell crab,
deep
definitely.
Fry it?
Yeah, I deep fry those.
It just has a shorter season. That's the problem with that.
Yeah.
Just fry the crab.
There is nothing like that good season. Crab. And Old Bay was made for crab cakes.
Yeah.
That's the seasoning mix. It's a lot of celery seed or a lot of celery salt and some other spices, a little bit of cayenne.
Do you put it in the crab, the fresh crab, or do you put it in the stuff you're going to coat the crab cake in?
Everything. Anytime now. And I agree with it because it's a seasoning specifically made for crab.
I've never
used it in anything else.
We will. We're gonna
What's in the Old Bay cocktail?
We've got to invent it.
Yeah. Oh, use that seasoning.
Put it into the Bloody Mary mix with your crab.
Oh, gosh.
Just stick with me. I'll tell you more about that later.
You can make, and I have made, gluten-free crab cakes using gluten-free panko. And that stuff really does work well. Huh. Because, again, when you make crab cakes, you want as little as this stuff as possible in your mix.
I bet we can make a seafood paella using Old Bay.
Absolutely.
Ooh, it would taste like the Chesapeake Bay.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's do
what
that.
What a good idea. With a lot of crab in it.
Oh, yeah.
Other thing I use it for is when I do crab bowls.
What a great idea.
Your water or your beer with the Old Bay.
Yeah.
And then you boil your crabs in them.
We have a lot of cooking to do.
Really
we do.
That's we're due for a paella.
That's
party,
summer
aren't we?
We need some favorable weather.
No snow.
And then we're going
out. Weather.
We're going outside. We're going to make paella. We do it the easy
way? Yeah, we should film it. Alex is our
Can I do
our
easy?
Guy.
No. Yes, you can.
Yes, you can.
All right, my friends. The Gluten-Free Cookbook for Two. These are great recipes. Anybody, no matter if you're gluten-free or not, you're going to want to make these. We love the local. Please support your local food growers and food makers. And for on-demand podcast delivery of this Food Schmooze Party every week and all of our curated recommendations for food, wine, cocktails, restaurants, all kinds of stuff, go to foodschmooze.org and we'll be right back.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. This show originally aired April 6th, 2017. This is the Food Schmooze Party, offering the richness of life and coming to you in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including Westchester County, the East End of Long Island. Of course, that includes the Hamptons. The senior producer is Robin Doyon Aiken. And to hear this show on WNPR, it airs Thursdays at 3. Podcasts and our curated recommendations are always online at foodschmooze.org. Okay, here we go. This is kind of fun because Carol Fenster has written 11 cookbooks. You might remember that she has done this book called 1,000 Gluten-Free Recipes.
She's contributed to Washington Post, New York Times, lives in Colorado. This is a very important book for people who are gluten-free or who have friends who are gluten-free and want to make the meal for everyone at the table, including the gluten-free person. So the gluten-free person doesn't have a separate dish. What if it's just two of you and one of you is gluten-free? All the recipes call for 4, 6, and 8 servings. So Carol has jumped right into this slot, and we're very grateful she has done this book called Gluten-Free Cooking for Two. So, Carol, welcome to the Food Schmooze Party.
I'm delighted to be with you all.
So, tell me, did you take recipes that you've already, I mean, you did 1,000 recipes. Did you take those recipes and then adapt them for two?
Yes. I had a blinding flash of the obvious one day, and I realized in my own life I had been cooking with full-size recipes all my lifetime. And now my husband and I were down to empty nesters, and I was wasting tons of food. You know, like you said before, most recipes are 4 to 6 servings. And I began seeing in the mainstream, there's nothing for gluten-free people who need to eat in 2-serving, 2-person meals. So, yes, and the recipes in the book, there's 125 of them, are really our family favorites, the things that we eat the most often.
Are you and your mate both gluten-free, or is just one of you gluten-free?
Just me. But he has been having to eat gluten-free with me for about the last 30 years.
Here's my question on that I think is the key to all this, as we get to your layered bean tortilla casserole in a cast iron skillet, which we just had here. It was so good. But how do you make dishes gluten-free where they're so good that you don't even have to tell the people at the table that they're gluten-free? How do you make it appealing for your mate as well as yourself?
Well, you have to have the right ingredients, first of all. And I think that we didn't have good ingredients 30 years ago. Now we have much better ingredients. The tortillas that you ate in the dish today, they're wonderful. We have great pastas. We have great flours now that we can use. And so it's a matter of taking the right ingredients and then figuring out the right proportions. And that's really key to balancing the flavors and trying to replicate the flavors that we remember. Mm-hmm. In my case, I grew up eating wheat. I was raised on a wheat farm. Wheat was a predominant food at our table. So I grew up with the flavor of wheat in my taste buds. And that's what's really hard, because our taste buds get accustomed to a certain way. Like, we think bread should taste a certain way, but what we're really tasting is wheat. And so what we gluten-free cooks have to do is rewrite the recipe to use the right blend of flours in this case, the right seasonings. Sometimes we use more seasonings to kind of balance the flavors.
Okay.
It's very interesting, and it's a chemistry project. Each recipe is like a big chemistry project.
Yeah, I like this. I like the architecture of what you're describing. I want to talk with Chris about this layered bean, and all of you here, because we just all ate this together.
Oh, yeah.
Your layered bean tortilla casserole. Think cast iron skillet. It makes 2 servings. This has corn tortillas, a can of black beans, or you could use pinto beans, salsa, fresh or frozen corn, some shredded Monterey Jack cheese, chopped cilantro if you have it, if you like it rather, and then you can use garnishes like sour cream or onion or avocado. So Chris, tell how easy it was.
First, Carol, I love this recipe. I loved it even more last night when I was putting it together. It's A, so simple to make, and B, uses basically everything I already had.
And
my
pantry
is loaded with this kind of stuff.
And this is on our website right now, foodschmooze.org. Okay, so tell us how this came together.
It's so easy. It's like mind-blowing. So corn tortillas, you spray or oil the bottom of a cast iron pan, or if you don't have that, you can use a little cake pan. That's what I used. Then you top it with drained and rinsed black beans, a little scoop of salsa. I used the salsa I had in my pantry, grabbed some frozen corn, put a little bit of that on there, and then topped it with cheese. Then another layer goes on, right? Another tortilla, and
so,
you do that
like
again.
A lasagna.
Yeah, then you do that again, and then you put another tortilla, and you do it one more time, leaving that open. Then it gets a little cilantro, and you toss it in the oven, covered first to get it nice and toasty.
Right.
And then you uncover it. It gets nice and crispy on the outside.
Oh, yeah.
Took it out of the oven, let it sit for a couple of minutes, and I cut it into quarters. And, oh, my God.
It was so delicious.
It is delicious.
The avocado is on top with sour cream. And, I mean, it's funny
because
I didn't have to buy anything to make this.
Yeah, with a little kava with this. Ooh. Fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that sounds so good. Something else that's great about that recipe is at 4 p.m. on any given day, about three-fourths of us don't even know what we're going to have for dinner that night. And you walk into the kitchen coming home from work like, what am I going to do that's quick? This thing can go together so quickly, and you'll have dinner on the table before you know it. And while it's baking, you can make a salad or set the table and all those things you have to do. But that's what I like about it. It's sort of an impromptu dish if you want to use it as one of your backups when you come home and you have nothing planned.
And I like what you say. You could use anything. Right?
Yeah.
Just use this as a template, but if you don't have beans in your pantry, oh well, and use something else.
Oh, sure.
Right? Chicken, shredded chicken, if you had it from like before.
Chickpeas.
Whatever you want. You have the tortillas and some cheese. You really can put whatever you want on this.
I mean, if you had frozen spinach, if you had frozen peas.
Yeah.
Really, just think of what can go in. So, Carol, I want to do something. This is Carol Fenster. Her book is called Gluten-Free Cooking for Two. 125 of her favorites. And I want to try something that is very much in season, because sometimes gluten-free eaters are not eating seasonally. They're more eating things they feel deprived of. So there's a lot of baked, a lot of crackers and breads and, you know. But this is not – asparagus soup normally doesn't have any problems with gluten anyway, right? So,
right.
But this is a very easy – soup using fresh asparagus of the season right now. That was just beautiful. And we put this on the website too, foodschmooze.org. Carol, tell me about this. You use gluten-free chicken or vegetable broth, right?
Right. There's a couple things that usually can go wrong with soups when it comes to gluten-free. One is the broth, because there are brands out there that do have wheat in them still.
Oh.
You got to read the labels, yeah. The other thing that can happen with soups, even though they seem to be sort of safe, is the how we thicken them. And so I avoided any major thickeners here. We use sweet rice flour or cornstarch as a thickener, but that's a safe thickener for folks who can't have wheat. I meant this to be a template for any kind of vegetable. So you basically cook the asparagus and the leeks, which add wonderful flavor.
Yeah.
Now we're back at that point that I mentioned earlier about trying to balance flavors and make sure that things taste just as normal as possible. You simmer that in the gluten-free chicken broth or vegetable broth if you want this to be a vegan or vegetarian dish, and a little bit of salt and pepper, and then whatever herb you like. I'm partial to thyme, but you might use dill, whatever is in season. You simply simmer it till the asparagus and leeks are done, and then you whirl it along with the thickener. You could either use sweet rice flour, which I really like, or cornstarch. And by the way, the sweet rice flour is not the same rice flour that you think of when you see a recipe that says brown rice flour or white rice flour. This is actually sweet rice flour, and it's made from the same sweet rice that you get in Chinese or Asian restaurants, like the stuff that clumps together. It's also called sticky rice, or sometimes, unfortunately, it's called glutinous rice. It doesn't have gluten, but it's called that.
Yeah.
You know? That's what we're talking about, and it's easily available through grocery stores.
And why do you like that?
It thickens more like wheat flour does. You know, if you use cornstarch, which is okay, it's a little shinier, more appropriate, I think, for desserts. But in this small amount, you're not going to notice it. If you hold up a dish thickened with wheat flour and then hold it up against one thickened with sweet rice flour, they will look far more alike than the one with cornstarch. Cornstarch lends that kind of glassy, glossy, translucent look.
Yes.
That you might not want in a savory dish.
Okay. Think about this. Think about how easy it is to make your own asparagus soup, where you've chopped up a leek and just the white parts. Then you've got the chicken broth or vegetable broth, a little tiny bit of butter, salt and pepper, and then the herb thing that Carol's talking about, and that rice flour, sweet rice flour, or if you can't get it, cornstarch. And what happens? You put the saucepan on, and you've got half the broth mixed with the asparagus, the leeks, the butter, the salt, and the pepper, and you bring it to a boil, let it simmer for a while, covered for about 5 minutes, and these leeks and asparagus are poaching in that broth. So now it's flavored, right? And then with a slotted spoon, you take the asparagus and leek out, and you put it in a blender. And you put the rest of the broth in there with the herbs and the rice flour, and you just puree it for about a minute, and it's incredibly smooth. And now it goes back into the pan, and you cook the soup. You can garnish with a few more leeks if you want, or whatever you want to do. Talk about fresh, seasonal, delicious. Yeah. I would put some snipped garlic chives on top of that.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's on our website, foodschmooze.org, including information about Carol Fenster's book. Carol, it's so hard to know what to talk with you about. There's so many things in here. How about if I don't let you get away, Carol, without talking about...
No problem.
I want you to talk about a dessert. I am a fan of carrot cake. Carrot cupcakes are just the best.
Oh, yeah.
And you have a recipe in here for these. This is, you've got a batter with Carol's gluten-free flour blend of your own design.
Yes.
Granulated sugar, brown sugar, so white and brown, cinnamon, xanthan gum, baking soda, salt, an egg, a little canola oil, crushed pineapple, shredded carrots, sweetened shredded coconut, and some chopped walnuts. Oh, you can see. How can this go wrong?
Yeah. These should be on Easter brunch table.
Now, I'm not someone who puts cream cheese frosting on my carrot cake or my carrot cupcakes. I know. I'm the only one on earth. I like a different frosting, but that's okay. Carol's got a beautiful cream cheese frosting in here for the majority of the people in America. Easy to do, right?
Very easy. I think the reason I put that in the book is, like you, I am a huge carrot cake fan. It's one of those recipes that has a lot of ingredients in it. And the problem with someone who's trying to wing it and convert a large, you know, most carrot cakes are like bundt cake size, huge. Trying to convert your own recipe down to be two servings is really, takes a lot of kitchen math. And so I thought, this is definitely a recipe that's got to go in the book, because I had to figure out just how much do you use of each ingredient to make all the flavors balance out and the texture be right and, you know, have it look and taste just like the real thing. And then I decided to bake them in cupcakes because I think cupcakes are the perfect solution when you're cooking for just two people. Mm. They're automatically proportioned for you. You don't have to cut into a cake and then worry about how do I keep that cake from going stale or drying out. But you make cupcakes and then you have enough for your one meal and then maybe a couple left. It makes six. You would actually have four left. But at least you can wrap them and store them. So
can you freeze them without the frosting?
Yeah, definitely. I freeze them all the time.
You could always eat two that day. Why do you have to have one?
Three, one for breakfast.
And don't forget your neighbors.
So one thing I learned is that measuring carefully is really critical in small-scale baking because the volume is so much smaller. And so whereas in a large full-scale recipe, maybe one tablespoon one way or the other isn't going to make that much difference, in a small recipe like this, it can make a huge difference. So I had to get it right.
Yeah.
The end result is carrot cake. What could be better?
Oh, and when you bite into and you get a little nut in there when you where you delicious. Carrot cake.
I would never advocate the idea of making two separate things, you know, one dessert for your gluten-free friends and one dessert for yourself. But, you know, maybe you're having a party and you really have your heart set on a dessert that is not gluten-free. Go ahead and make that. These cupcakes are easy enough, and I would not mind in this case, because they are so good, making a separate dessert for my gluten-free friends.
Yeah. But if I'm not gluten-free, I have no problem eating these.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yep. So this is on our website, too, Carrot Cake Cupcakes at foodschmooze.org, including information about your book. Very quickly in this last minute, this is kind of a dirty trick, but what do you grew up on a wheat farm?
Yeah.
What do you think accounts for the rising numbers of people who have become gluten sensitive or discovered they have celiac, but mostly it's a high level of gluten sensitive people? What do you think is happening?
There's several theories that are posed. One is that we were always there. We just were diagnosed with something else. You know, that's one possible theory. There's been research that's shown, though, out of the Mayo Clinic, that the percentage of people that have celiac disease has actually grown at a very high rate since they were taking data back right after World War II. One of the theories that's advanced by one of our leading doctors, Dr. Fasano, is that there might be something going on with our gut structure. I don't know that anyone knows for sure, and I'm certainly not an expert in the why. It's just that we need gluten-free food, just like a diabetic needs insulin.
As doctors will tell you, people are coming in and saying something is wrong when I eat anything with wheat in it, and they're not making it up. So I'm so glad we had a chance to talk about this. Love your book. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. You all were delightful to talk with.
Enjoy Colorado.
Bye-bye.
Carol Fenster, author of Gluten-Free Cooking for Two. Thanks, my buddies.
We're on WNPR Thursdays at 3 and never eat more than you can lift. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
Everybody eats when they come to mind.